Sure. So what big scoring project are you working on these days?
I got 4 movies I'm working on right now.
Wow.
One of them should have been done a while ago, but it's just about finished now, called Envy. It's Ben Stiller and Jack Black and Chris Watkins.
Uh-huh.
And Barry Levinson's directing it. And it's almost done now.
Okay.
It just kind of got turned inside out. And
well, I probably listen to your stuff every day because my kids are always watching Rugrats on Nickelodeon, so.
Oh, uh-huh. Yep, there.
It's like one of their favorite shows.
Yep, we're busy infiltrating the minds of young kids every day.
That's right. Well, I'll get right to it then. I'm really looking forward to this this art tour you have coming to. I guess you're making a stop in Oklahoma City, at least your art is.
Yeah.
Most people know you for your music. How did you get involved with this graphic art?
Well, actually, that's what I went to school for. I always was a visual artist and was doing gallery shows when Devo kind of like sort of kicked into high gear, and that still provided an outlet because we made these films back then and did all our own graphics and album covers and posters and outfits and stuff. We designed everything ourselves, so it was still kind of we were always you know, like working in the visual realm, and I just kind of went through different periods of doing gallery shows over the last 25 years where, you know, I'd do it for a year and then get out of it for 4 or 5 years and then do it again. And this time I got into it just kind of had been wanting to do some shows again. And my music studio, I have it set up now so I can do my artwork while I'm here too, and print things here at work and still stay on schedule with everything else I'm doing. So it's so it's kind of just turned out to be the time.
So in a way, the band kind of got in the way of you doing your art.
Well, not really, because we were all visually oriented artists. We all, our music, some of the music we wrote, we had ideas for short films. You know, I mean, we weren't calling them promo videos because, you know, we didn't even think of it that way. We were making little art pieces. And so we would make these little films, and sometimes we had the idea for the film before we ever wrote the song. And so, you know, it certainly didn't get in the way, but it took the emphasis away from doing, you know, things in galleries. And I don't know, it's just the last about 4 years I got interested in you know, things that were happening in the world with like ideologies clashing and America becoming a unipower, and I don't know, it just seemed like the right time to do these shows. So,
what do you get from that art form that you don't get from doing your music? You're able to express different ideas or something like that?
Well, when I'm working on films, it's basically no matter what else you say, you're supplying music for somebody else's vision. You're helping them complete their vision. And so, you know, it's a collaborative art form, and it's empathetic art form. And when I'm doing the pieces that'll be in the show, a lot of them are just like they're like stream of consciousness and affected by things right at the moment that are much more personal than you know, when I'm scoring like a movie for Wes Anderson. I mean, that's probably not even the best example. Probably when I'm scoring a Rugrats movie is a better example. It's that's a lot less personal and involves, you know, like so many people in the decision making, and has so many, you know, prerequisites with that come with it. Whereas when I'm doing the artwork that's in this show, it was just things I was doing that, like for every piece I do, there's about 100 of them I would never show anybody for, you know, for mostly just embarrassing reasons, because I don't censor it, and I just, and it would, you know, it could be just, you know, just documenting, you know, like maybe somebody from a film company standing in front of the television set at lunchtime expounding on the virtues of an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie or you know, dishing out bullshit about from the Hollywood Reporter they were just regurgitating from their breakfast reading, or, you know, so oftentimes it was things that I don't really need people to see what the artwork I'm doing, but I just picked ones that I thought might interest other people and put them together, and they're out there, and as far as the show's concerned, I'm kind of doing smaller galleries on this tour than I've ever done, and part of it is because of what turned me on about it was. I've been reading, you know, a friend of mine publishes this magazine called Juxtapose, a guy named Robert Williams. You know, through that magazine, I became interested in, you know, not the Robert Williams and the Mark Rydens of the world, although, you know, I'm friends with them and I like those guys, but more interested in like, all these, like, kind of smaller galleries, and there'd be ads for, like, new upcoming artists that are younger, you know, or probably 30 years younger than Robert, for instance, and there, and you see these little, you know, out of the way galleries that, you know, you know they're the product of just a couple guys that just got out of college, and, you know, they found some garage or warehouse space somewhere, you know, downtown in Detroit or wherever, you know. North Carolina or something, you know, and they found this space, and they're bringing art, you know, fresher art and younger art to more to the grassroots. You know, it's not like Tony Schifrazzi or James Corcoran or any of the big galleries, Mary Boone or something. You know, this isn't, you know, these galleries that I became interested in aren't the ones that are going to be selling art to corporate collections, you know, for bank portfolios or investment purposes. I shouldn't say investment purposes, because probably a lot of the artwork that they sell could end up having an investment value someday. But I mean, it's not like artwork for you know, bankers and lawyers. It's more about ideas and concepts and. What, you know, I'm doing something right now. Okay. Sorry about that. I totally distracted.
No, it's okay. Would that be today's equivalent of what you guys were trying to accomplish, you know, starting off,
yeah,
you know, 30 years ago?
I think so, because you meet these people at these galleries, and, you know, they're energetic and well-meaning and idealistic, and, you know, it's kind of like Devo in the early days was, you know, we were kind of like our own little rascals. You know, it never occurred to us that you hire a publicity company or a commercial ad agency or a commercial production company to come up with ideas and shoot videos for you. We thought it was the other way around. We thought it would be absurd if the artist didn't create it. And so because of it, you know, it's like, personally to me, MTV was a shocking and revolting thing when it finally quickly turned into what it turned into, which was, you know, just, you know, a way for record companies to sell their crap, you know. And I was hoping for a new art form that would wipe out rock and roll and would wipe out, and would give, you know, give artists a chance to venture into new territory, and that turned out to be, at best, it was an accidental. It happens accidentally every now and then. At worst, mostly it's just, you know, ways to sell old music, and still continues to do that. But enough of the MTV. I don't. But where were we? We were talking about. Oh, so anyhow. So I just like these galleries with the young artists. I like seeing what kids are doing and what gets them off. And so with this show, I thought, well, I'm going to price this stuff as cheap as I possibly can. As a matter of fact, quite. You know, it just is. It's as cheap as I could price it, and still the gallery could make a little bit of money because, you know, they got to exist.
Right.
So I called the show Homefront Invasion because I envision it is my chance to invade people's homes around the world. You know, and I don't know how many pieces are going to sell. So far, sold, you know, 200 or 300 pieces. So, you know, it'll probably double, is my guess, just based on how many shows are left. It'll probably double before the year's out, and that'll be a bunch of living rooms to be in.
Well, I think you're kind of invading people's homes anyway, and they probably don't even realize it, you know, with the scoring you do for commercials and movies and TV shows. Do you get that a lot where people say to you, you know, I had no idea you did that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, people come over here and hire me for, you know, like a Coke commercial, and, you know, sometime before, you know, after they've been here a day and a half, they're walking through the hallways and they go, why do you have platinum records for Devo? You know, or they'll see a Rugrats poster and go, oh, you had something to do with that, you know, and you know, vice versa. They don't always know about each other, about the different areas we're in. So, yeah.
You had kind of mentioned your disdain for for MTV, and just in reading other interviews with you, you seem to have kind of soured on the music biz a bit, at least as far as, you know, stuff you were producing with the band was concerned.
Well, it's the music industry. It's not like anybody gets into it naively thinking that it's like this great, wonderful business to be in, because it's not, you know. It is a big evil septic tank, but it's an exciting one, you know, and it's kind of great for a while, and especially when you're young, you know, Devo just kind of, we thought, well, or what are we going to do? Be Ohio's version of the band The Residents? I don't know if you know who they are, but they were like this kind of oddball band that was out in the mid-70s, about the same time we were first started pressing singles in Ohio and making our first films. We thought, let's just see how far we can take it. And so you know,
The Residents, they were the band with the big eyeball heads.
Big eyeball guys.
Right.
Yeah, H and Homer. And
yeah, they were big in Minneapolis. That's where I used to live.
Yeah, I like those guys. But I thought, you know, that would be easy. We could be the Akron version of those guys forever, or the Akron Pier Ubu. And we thought, well, Let's see how strong the aesthetic is. Let's see how, if we can permeate the culture or not. And so, you know, we took the challenge, and you know, the record industry wasn't really that receptive to us. And even when they did become receptive, it was for the wrong reasons. So it was an interesting journey. It's like I don't have an interest in repeating it. I think it'd even be harder now to be in a band and trying to break into that. The only good thing about it now is that there's no reason to do it unless you just totally love the music you do. It's you know, it's so economically unsound and an unwise idea for somebody to be in a band. You know, that you just do it because you're compelled to. That's the only reason to be in the record business now.
I had read somewhere that you thought the Freedom of Choice album was sort of the beginning of the end for the band. Did success kind of take away from the enjoyment of what you guys were doing?
It was more like what it did is it put us on the radar over at Warner's and Virgin Records, where we were on both labels at the same time. We got Virgin for Europe and Warner's for everywhere else, and it just put us on their radar screen. So then all of a sudden we had people like Lenny Waronker, who was president of Warner's, who had no interest. He didn't even know we were on his label, I'm sure, until we had a hit record. And then he went, oh, I can make some money off of these guys. So then he showed up at, you know, when we were recording the next album, New Traditionalists, he showed up in the studio and like actually sat at the console and wanted to try and mix some of the music, and you know, we knew it was a bad sign. Yeah,
that sounds no good at all.
We somehow made it to the third album without his help. You know, made it through three albums and 20 some videos, and three world tours without his help, and now he wanted to help us. So then it became, you know, so then the next album then was the one where, you know, of course, in their infinite wisdom and trying to help us, they didn't let us put the song Coal Mine, Working in a Coal Mine, on the New Traditionalist album. And so we just, it was kind of a throwaway, and we gave it to some movie called Heavy Metal.
And I have that soundtrack, actually.
And Heavy Metal put, when they, that song was the hit off of that album. And it came out about a month and a half before New Traditionalists did. And so all of a sudden we had a hit song on the charts that was there because that was on Elektra Asylum instead of on Warner Brothers, because you know, the people at Warner Brothers that wanted to, you know, like that were using their greedy intuition, they had in their all-knowing, you know, wisdom had stopped us from putting that song on the Nutritionist album. So then they actually included it as a free single on the first like 100,000 or 200,000 albums. They put it in as a free single, trying to defuse Elektra Asylum having it on their label. It was just, you know, such a weird comedy, the whole business thing.
I heard this great quote from you too. You said being in a band is really cool when you're 20. It's kind of Spinal Tap-ish when you're 30, and by the time you're 40, it's just touring. You know, touring, just forget it.
Well, it's just you shouldn't be doing it because the first time you see 20 Motel Sixes in 20 days, you know, it's kind of interesting, and by the fourth or fifth time, shame on you. You should know better. Shouldn't be doing that.
Well, what about these bands that, you know, they've been around for, you know, 20, 30 years, and, you know, they're cranking out the, One Last Time tours and things like that? Is that something you think they're strictly doing for the money?
I don't know. I guess they just, I'm really lucky, because I found life after rock and roll. So, you know, what do you do after, you know, what do you do if you've, like, all your life you've wanted to write music and be an artist, and you get one chance with a record company, and you do your two records or your one record or your three records or your one single or whatever you got to do, and then they tell you, well, we're done with you, basically. You know, it's an awful place to be in. You know, it's to be the one trick pony, and you know, not being able to give it up. You know, it's like, personally, I think people should be a little more should have a little more grace than that, but you know, it's, you know, who am I to criticize or you know, what other people do? You know, it's hard to be an artist sometimes.
You still get radio airplay though, and I mean, I even heard a Devo song at a Target commercial. I mean, why do you think the music stands the test of time like that?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the music was, it was good for what it was, you know, and it was kind of interesting and unique. And the one thing you can say about Devo music is there wasn't really anything else that sounded like it. You know, it was for better or for worse. And probably from a commercial standpoint, in the 80s, it was for worse, you know, because Although we did, you know, a lot of experimentation with, you know, what later turned out to be either industrial or even more trancey kind of stuff. It would be funny if you heard some of the music we used to write back then. It's like other people did it much better, and, you know, people like Kurt Cobain wrote better angst punky songs, and Nine Inch Nails did better industrial songs, and we were just kind of early explorers. But what we did do did have kind of an interesting sound to it, and in a way, it's like I go back and listen to records and I like some of it more than I did. It's like some of the later stuff that I really, when we did it, I was really upset with it, and it was not sounding the way I was trying to make it sound or the way we were trying to make it sound. It's like I go back now and I listen to it, and I kind of enjoy it more than I did 20 years ago, 15 years ago.
Is there anything you did and you listen to it today and you're like, oh, my God, I just never want to listen to that again?
There's stuff that I think should never have come out, and most of it is, you know, like probably letting, you know, like these Devo geek fans from Rhino Records kind of go through the basement and pull out like weird, odd experiments and stuff that I can't imagine even really damaged Devo fans enjoying listening to. Just because they hear some different lyrics in a demo or a bad sketch or something, they put these things on some of these odd records, but they only got out to so many people, so, you know, it's like, you know, it was kind of like a buyer beware when you're buying stuff that is, you know, it's obviously out of somebody's basement. So,
well, who do you like listening to these days?
You know what, that's a hard one to say, because of the movie one of the movies I'm working on right now, I've been listening to a lot of like older material, like Ukulele Ike, and even pre-30s music, more like late 20s high society music. Right about the time Gershwin was getting involved, and right before him, you know, the songwriting that was going on then. But for contemporary music, I don't know. I hear a lot of stuff. You know, it's like people send me things. I buy records. I go through different phases. It's like when I was working out for some Devo stuff, I was getting into more of the electronic, current electronic music, and, you know, I hear a lot of different things that are interesting.
So when people go to see your gallery tour, they shouldn't be expecting any kind of a Devo retrospective or anything like that. It's definitely not that.
No, it's only in the most abstract sense, because the artwork that's on the walls was part of a larger collection that was also kind of the main image bank that Devo would go to find album covers and to find things. But there's nothing overtly, you know, there's not like other Freedom of Choice sketches and stuff. You know, like when the idea for the album cover came up, and for the, some of the singles that came out on that for that album, we'd go to these collections of images that I was saving and drawing at the time, and we'd find a lot. That'd be the source material for a lot of this stuff. But this stuff here is just kind of one worried reporter, you know, kind of giving his version of what he sees going on in the world at any particular moment.
Well, Mark, like I said, I'm a big fan, and I look forward to seeing it when it arrives here in Oklahoma City.
Okay, I hope there's something there you like.
I'm sure there will be. Well, I know you're a real busy guy. Thanks a lot for your time today.
All right, thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye.
And then we have remedied the situation. We've put you on our email list. I don't know why you weren't on there, but from now on, you will get a storm of emails from me.
All right. That's great.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So today is the last day that people can apply for federal disaster assistance. Now, does that mean if they don't call in by, what is it, 8 o'clock tonight?
6 o'clock.
They're out in the cold?
We're urging people to make that call to the FEMA Disaster Assistance Line and apply for disaster assistance if they haven't done that already. The deadline to do that is 6 o'clock this evening. People need to call 1-800-621-FEMA.
Now, I think it was last week or so, Governor Henry said that you guys basically know that there are still people who have not applied for assistance.
Typically, in a disaster like the one we have experienced back in May, we do have people who wait till the last minute for whatever reason or simply prejudge their eligibility for assistance. And we are urging them today, now that we're at a little less than 3 hours away from the deadline, to not prejudge their eligibility. Let me start that again. We're urging people to avoid prejudging their I can't say that today now.
Eligibility.
Sorry. Hold on. Okay. We urge Oklahomans to not prejudge their eligibility. Simply calling the 800 number and registering over the phone for disaster assistance leaves your